All right, good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today is February 15th. The first order of business is to call the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Eklund.
I'll call you back, buddy.
Eklund, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner.
Bonner, present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Bolden, present.
Damoth.
Damoth, present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Kernhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Present.
Everyone is here. A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. Quorum is present. So the next order of business is to approve the minutes of yesterday, February 14th. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Chair.
Oh, I love this. Everybody wants to be the, everyone wants to move the minutes. This is a great way to start a hearing. Okay. Let's have Representative Bonner moves approval of the
Madam
minutes.
Chair. Thank you. I will move the minutes for February 14th, 2022.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Bonner. And thank you, all my volunteers. I love it. It's better to have too many than too few. And so is the minutes having been moved, is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please unmute yourself and say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you very much. Okay, we have two bills on the agenda for today. The first one is House File 3162, Representative Freiberg. And Representative Freiberg, I understand that you have an author's amendment. So my question to you is, did you want to just put that on before you discuss the bill and then we'll discuss it as amended? Or
sure.
What is your preference?
Sure. If it's okay with you, I would just move first that House File 3162 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. And I would then move the author's amendment coded A1.
Very good. All right. The bill has been moved and the amendment is moved. And Representative Freiberg, did you need to say anything about the amendment or?
It's technical. It's a technical amendment, Madam Chair. It reflects suggestions from the Department of Health. I can certainly answer questions if anybody has any on it, though.
All right. Well, let's adopt that then, and then we will discuss the bill as amended. So all in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. So Representative Freiberg, to your bill is amended and we have some testifiers, but to you or to whoever was going to present the bill.
Sure, I'll just provide a few introductory comments, but I'll be brief because it's, I think, more important to hear from the testifiers. So we discussed this issue last April as part of our omnibus bill, and we added an amendment allowing for a tribal medical cannabis program that could work in conjunction with the existing Minnesota medical cannabis program. There were a couple issues highlighted during the discussion we had around that amendment. As sovereign governments, tribes like White Earth and Red Lake can create their own medical cannabis programs that operate within the borders of their lands, but there can be complications. So, for example, a tribal member enrolled in a tribal medical cannabis program who leaves the boundaries of a reservation can be charged with possession under Minnesota law as it currently stands. So the language we added to the omnibus bill did not become law, but we've continued to have discussions between the Department of Health, the tribes, and other stakeholders. And the result is this bill, which is a more fleshed out version. It basically authorizes the governor to enter into negotiations with the tribe to create a compact spelling out how the tribal medical cannabis program will operate when Minnesota laws apply. It makes it clear that tribal medical cannabis programs can transport medical cannabis to testing laboratories within Minnesota under specified conditions, And there are several tribal representatives here. So as I said, I think it's probably more important to hear from them. So I will just turn it over to the testifiers.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Representative Freiberg. So first on our list, we have, we have some very distinguished testifiers here today. So first on our list, we have Chairman Michael Fairbanks, who is the chairman of the White Earth Tribal Nation. Welcome, Chairman Fairbanks. If you would please, for the record, just state your name and please go ahead and give us your testimony.
Okay, thank you. I want to say Ani Bouju, Madam Chair, and also members of the committee. My name is Michael Fairbanks. I served as elected chairman of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today in support of House File 3162 regarding tribal medical cannabis. In 2020, the White Earth Nation held a referendum where the people voted overwhelmingly, around 90% in favor, to authorize the tribe to invest in medical cannabis. Since that time, we have taken numerous steps to move forward. I would like to turn it over to our general counsel, Leonard Finday, who will further explain how we got to this point and what we are seeking to accomplish through this legislation. Now, I want to say miigwech to everyone there. Thank you for your time today.
All right. Thank you, Chairman Fairbanks. Before we go to Mr. Finday, I would like to welcome Chairman Seki from the Red Lake Nation, and if that's okay, and then we'll go to Mr. Finday. So, Chairman Seki, welcome to the committee, and please just give us your name for the record.
Daryl G. Seki, Senior, Chairman of Red Lake Nation. And the Red Lake Nation developed its medical cannabis program after being informed that Red Lake members overwhelmingly support this medical option. Through an advisory vote, 83% of Red Lake tribal members affirmed their support for the tribe's development of its own medical cannabis program. In response to a tribal member vote, the Red Lake Nation has enacted its own medical cannabis regulatory system, and we have developed our own state-of-the-art facility for manufacturing medical cannabis. Because of our unique status in Indian country as a closed reservation, the Red Lake Nation has full civil and criminal jurisdiction over all matters on the Red Lake Reservation, including the ability to fill medical cannabis prescriptions for residents and non-residents of the reservation. Red Lake does not desire to operate its state's existing medical cannabis regulatory framework. Instead, the tribe supports changes to the state's existing medical cannabis laws, which clarify the tribe's ability to provide medical cannabis to Red Lake members and to other Minnesota citizens who chose to fill their prescriptions through Red Lake program. The Red Lake Nation will participate in the medical cannabis marketplace in Minnesota in a responsible manner and will share the state medical cannabis regulators our experiences with the goal of maximizing consumer protection and safety and security and accountability. Our procedures for manufacturing medical cannabis product prioritize the conservation of natural resources, including water, protection against adverse environmental impacts. All medical cannabis products manufactured in Red Lake will be laboratory tested and subject to quality control measures to ensure safety for human consumption. We are seeking the ability to transport medical cannabis product to off-reservation testing facilities so that we may assure that quality control standards are met. Because of the economic development and potential of medical cannabis manufacturing, particularly in the Indian country, we are requesting the legislature again prioritize the production of local homegrown medical cannabis to supply the Minnesota market. I want to say chimigwech for allowing me to speak in behalf of Red Lake Nation on this cannabis program we're establishing in our reservation. Miigwech.
Thank you, Chairman Seki. And now, Seki, I'm sorry. Oh, gosh. Sorry. And thank you for correcting me. And now we will go to Mr. Finday. Welcome, Mr. Finday. Please give your name and introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Leonard Finday, and I serve as the General Counsel for the White Earth Nation. And I want to thank you and the committee for having this hearing today and for allowing us to be here. I also want to thank Chairman Siki from Red Lake and Chairman Fairbanks from White Earth for opening us up today and introducing the issue. As both chairs spoke to already, both reservations, White Earth and Red Lake, have held referendum votes of the tribal membership, and overwhelmingly on both reservations, the people expressed desire for each individual tribe, White Earth and Red Lake, to regulate and operate medical cannabis within the boundaries of our respective reservations. This happened at White Earth in 2020. The position that the White Earth leadership has taken, being in a little bit different situation from the Red Lake Nation, from the outset, White Earth has wanted to be as cooperative and as collaborative with the state and federal government as possible. And so in that vein, we have consulted with Governor Walz directly. We have also had numerous conversations with the Minnesota Department of Health, as well as the Office of Medical Cannabis within the Department of Health, as well as federal stakeholders too. What the legislation before the committee today represents is the best efforts of all three parties, White Earth, Red Lake, and the state of Minnesota, to come to as much of a collaborative agreement as possible to ensure that there's seamless jurisdiction in the operation of medical cannabis in the state of Minnesota, that medical cannabis is meeting the needs of those who require cannabis for medicine, and that all medical cannabis participants are treated fairly throughout the state of Minnesota. Importantly, as Chairman Siki noted, one of the primary things I want to discuss today is the transportation language that's within this bill. That transportation language allows a tribal medical cannabis program to transport cannabis within the state to laboratories in St. Paul as well as to other Indian lands. This is very important because there is a testing laboratory in St. Paul that the current two state licensees, Vireo and Leafline, use to test their product. And that lab in St. Paul has a very high standard for its testing and has the ability to test it at a global, that in a standard that meets global requirements, not just state requirements or national requirements, but global requirements. It tests for a number of things, not only additives, but also parasites and heavy metals and things like that, that would be difficult for us to engineer such a laboratory within the tribal lands of either of our reservations. And so as both reservations are moving forward with the medical cannabis program, we really do feel like this is a priority to ensure that our cannabis would be able to be tested at that lab in Minnesota so that we're sure that it meets those stringent quality control standards. Another area of the legislation is regarding tribal state compacting with in the industry of cannabis. This is a really interesting area because this is one of those rare circumstances where should this move forward in Minnesota, we would be breaking new ground, but not reinventing the wheel. We've seen other states in the union adopt similar legislation for tribal state cannabis compacts. Some of those states include Nevada, Washington State, and Arizona. But this is the first time that I'm aware of where a state is considering adopting tribal state compact language specifically tailored to a medical cannabis program and not to an adult use program or what's commonly referred to as recreational. And that's what this language seeks to accomplish. Importantly, both White Earth and Red Lake have medical cannabis programs, meaning that cannabis is only authorized for medical purposes to treat medical conditions, those qualifying conditions. And so we're not seeking recreational approval. We're not seeking adult use approval. We're seeking what's already authorized in Minnesota law, which is that medicinal use of cannabis. And importantly, even though we've seen these tribal state compacts in other states and they work out very well, this is the first time we are trying to do it in a state where it is only medical. And so that's where there are some issues that come into play with regard to qualifying conditions, with regard to patient registration, and with regard to possession. And that's where we are still working with the Department of Health on appropriate language that would cover those areas, the civil and criminal liability protections, as well as the purchasing requirements. Right now, within the legislation that's before the committee today, there's a dual registration that's noted within that legislation. In conversation with the Department of Health yesterday, we're looking at still working on possibly making some amendments to that, just to make sure that it works with the state system as it currently is. But the ultimate goal, as I previously stated, is to ensure that both tribal and state programs are operable as seamlessly as possible, and that the medicine is able to treat the people who need it as fairly as possible. Importantly, even though White Earth and Red Lake are the only two tribal nations in the state of Minnesota to be moving forward in the medical cannabis industry, the way this legislation is crafted is that if any of the other nine federally recognized tribes in the state of Minnesota were to pursue a medical cannabis program, they would be eligible for these same protections and the same process that we're outlining in this legislation. So it's not just exclusive to White Earth or Red Lake, but it's for all tribes in Minnesota. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions. And I do believe we have others that are also available to answer questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Finday. That is very helpful. And we're also moving very expeditiously. So this is great, because I think we do have time. Certainly, we would take questions, but we are doing well on time. So questions from members. Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Mr. Finday, you mentioned that the am I clear that the qualifying conditions would be the same for the tribes as they are for the state? Are they exactly the same, or are your qualifying conditions taken from what the state has said are qualifying conditions to prescribe the medical cannabis?
Mr. Finday.
Madam Chair, Representative Auckland, the way that WIDERS program is structured, we have a medical cannabis code that specifies that you need to have an underlying condition, but then the code refers to our regulatory body, the Medical Cannabis Control Board, to outline those underlying qualifying conditions. And so that will be in the wider structure. That's part of our regulatory system. So there's the possibility that the qualifying conditions would be more or less than the state's, not exactly lined up to the state of Minnesota's. But the way that WIDERS program is structured is in such a way that any decision of the Cannabis Control Board to add or to make a condition a qualifying condition, there needs to be a scientific and healthcare industry rationale and justification for making that condition qualifying for the medicine.
Thank you. Representative Ackland, any follow-up to that?
Thank you for your answer. And I had a second question. You were talking about dual registration. And you said your ultimate goal was to ensure so just explain to me how that dual registration works and how that is a safeguard for this program.
Mr. Finday.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Ackland. So dual registration, first and foremost, we're seeking that because we have a very transient population on the reservation. The tribal members that live on the reservation have family and sometimes property they own off the reservation. We have a very large urban population in the Twin Cities area. And so the primary reason for seeking this is if there's a tribal participant who's traveling off the reservation to visit family or stay with family, and they were to be stopped by law enforcement, we want to ensure that they're still protected against criminal prosecution for possession of cannabis. And so that's the primary purpose for seeking something similar to dual registration. Now, where we're running into a little bit of an issue is we just had a call yesterday morning with the Office of Medical Cannabis. Both Red Lake and White Earth were on that call. And we heard from folks in the Office of Medical Cannabis that their system isn't really set up, their software system isn't really set up to allow for dual registration. So we're working on some language around that would still get us to that point where a tribal medical cannabis patient would traveling off the reservation would still not be criminally charged with possession. That's first and foremost. The second thing is again, seeking that we have a transient population. We also wanted to ensure that if there is a tribal program participant who is near a state dispensary, that they would be able to go into a state dispensary and purchase product. And likewise, with the reciprocity, we wanted to be able to sell our product to those enrolled in the state's system as well. And that's where dual registration that came from, because that just made it sound easier to do it that way. But given the limitations on the software that's being used right now, we're going to have to look at some alternative language, which we're working through right now, to get us to a point where we can still meet both those goals.
Okay. Representative Acklin, you look like you have another question. I have two other hands up. Did you have a brief follow-up?
I'm finished. Okay. I'm finished and just thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Representative Bierman and then Gernhagen. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Finde. Representative Acklin asked my first question, but I just wanted to clarify what I heard in the answer to the first question was related to qualifying conditions. And what I heard was that the conditions may start out the same, but could change over time. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And then the second question I had unrelated was patient age. Would that start out the same as the state program as well? And could that potentially deviate over time?
Mr. Finde.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Bierman. I'm unsure of the state's age requirement, but I can tell you that the tribal cannabis program does not allow for anybody under the age of 21.
Very good. Thank you. And the next question I had, you answered about the state dispensaries, so thank you for that answer. And I am good, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Bierman. Representative Gernhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was thinking of offering a delete all amendment, but I decided not to. No. That's an inside joke for the testifiers. Say, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, a couple questions. First, cannabis is still illegal federally. My understanding is that the tribal land is under federal jurisdiction. So has there been any discussion with U.S. attorneys how this would work out, or if you'd like to respond to that? And I have another question.
Okay, and who was that for, Representative Gernhagen?
Whoever thought they were authorized to answer it or could answer.
Okay. Mr. Finde, if you'd like to.
Yeah, I think I can answer for White Earth, but I think that maybe Ms. Chairman Seeky or Mr. Plummer might want to answer for Red Lake, because we are in two separate categories as it relates to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I can say for White Earth, we have had conversation with the U.S. Attorney's Office. Those conversations are ongoing. We've been very open with them about our program. That's why we have requirements that have been outlined by the Department of Justice in prior memorandums that they have released with regard to cannabis programs. We are also working on getting a meeting set up with the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, as well. Again, just to ensure that our program meets the requirements and isn't going to be subject to federal prosecution. And at this point, we're in a good position with both agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Finde. And I'll go to Chairman Siki, but I do want to say, though, that this is not really within the jurisdiction of this committee, and the bill will be making other stops. So I think it's an interesting question, but not one we have to resolve here today. Chairman Siki, did you want to comment on that as well?
Madam Chair, I'll have our legal counsel, Joe Plummer, make a comment on that.
All right. Yes. Thank you. Mr. Plummer, if you would just state your name and title and then go ahead, please.
Yes, Joe, J-O-E, Plummer, P-L-U-M-E-R, legal counsel for the Red Lake Band of Chippewa. And I can let you know that this was a concern of ours at Red Lake from the beginning. And so we've met three separate times with the DEA. The main enforcement office for our region, of course, is out of Omaha. So we met the Omaha folks. They met us in Minneapolis. The Red Lake Tribe developed an apartment building in South Minneapolis, and we met in the meeting room there. And two of the assistant U.S. attorneys from Minnesota also joined the DEA folks from Omaha. We had a very positive, productive conversation. We've had two other Zoom meetings with that same group. And, you know, as Mr. Finde mentioned, we've done the same thing. We've been transparent and open, you know, with all of the feds. We recognize the jurisdictional mazes probably more than most, primarily because of the closed reservation status up at Red Lake. So we deal with the feds primarily. So we're used to that stuff. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Plummer. Okay. Did you have a follow-up? Representative Gernhagen, yeah. I see you've got one more hand up. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks for that answer. Appreciate the update. The other question I have is the medical cannabis, my understanding is in Minnesota right now, is subject to certain fees and taxes. Would that also apply to your facility on the tribal lands?
And Mr. Finde, could you address that one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I can, Representative Grunhagen, I can just address it to the fact that we haven't had those conversations yet. So our conversations have been focused on the jurisdictional questions with regard to the operation of a program. We haven't really had conversations with the state with regard to revenue, but we definitely be open to that in consultation with Commissioner Doty at the Department of Revenue to make sure that we're getting that issue clarified and straightened out as jurisdictionally appropriate.
Thank you. And Mr. Plummer, did you want to also, or Chairman Siki, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Yes. Chair Liebling,
please.
It's more of an internal issue for us. We primarily wanted to make, you know, the medical cannabis affordable, you know, for the tribal members on the reservation. So we were not thinking about adding on extra taxes and fees of that nature. We have in our business plan built in, you know, the cost that will make all of this cash flow for us and pay back our investment on this building. So we weren't thinking about any taxes or fees, you know, being added to this. Our primary concern was to make the medicine affordable for tribal members.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to go on to Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when I look at that, as I see the sovereignty and to the state and the tribes, negotiating the boundary conditions, you know, transport through. The only major thing that I'm concerned about is non-tribal members then going onto the reservation, to purchase medical marijuana, or if there was somehow it got to be some people use that as a way to get some recreational, and the boundary condition of someone that's using it, we don't have a good breathalyzer type test. So these are general concerns that I hope would be worked out when you do your agreements. But I know there was a great deal of debate when we took up medical, and I just want to make sure that what happens here doesn't adversely impact what we've tried to do in the state itself. And I didn't know if you had some comments on that general topic and area, and thank you.
All right, well, Representative Quam, I think it's more to the whole general topic of medical cannabis. So maybe if the question is what their experience or thinking is about their own programs, maybe that would be the way to ask the question, just as a question of general interest. Mr. Findlay, you look like you want to answer, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Quam. First and foremost, I want to say that for White Earth, our primary focus is our tribal member on reservation population. That is our primary focus with our program. So with people coming onto the reservation and attempting to use it for recreational purposes, I can assure Representative Quam that that's not the intent of White Earth's program at all. And the only individuals who will be eligible to purchase from White Earth's medical cannabis program would be individuals who have a medical cannabis card, either from the state, if this dual registration or visiting patient issue gets straightened out, or from our own tribal members. And in order to have that card, you have to have a qualifying condition. And so there's no idea or intent or purpose to circumvent that at all from White Earth's perspective, and also from what I understand from Red Lake's perspective. But I'll let Red Lake speak to their program. With regard to the testing of it or driving while impaired or under the influence, yes, that is a concern. I don't have a solid answer for that. I can tell you within the tribal cannabis code that was adopted by White Earth, that's one of the things that remains prohibited. But how we actually test for that, I think that's something we're going to have to let science catch up to.
Thank you. And I see Ms. York has her hand up. Welcome. Please just introduce yourself and go ahead. If you want to add a comment to that, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Laurie York, and I'm the Executive Director for White Earth Nation. And I just wanted to provide a comment that we have had conversations with Commissioner Harrington regarding additional field sobriety tests to help address the marijuana under the influence concerns that there may be. Butch, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. York. And then Chairman Siki or Mr. Plummer, did you want to add anything? You don't have to, but you're welcome to if you wish.
Okay, Chair Liebling, thanks for that. The only thing I would like to add is we want to make it clear that the Red Lake Nation has not legalized recreational cannabis, that we have the same types of qualifying conditions as the state does. But there's one critical difference, and that is PTSD. We have a lot of combat veterans here, and we believe that is an important addition, to the qualifying conditions. And as far as the concern of non-members coming on to the reservation, if they have their own prescription and they meet the state's qualifying condition, then we'll likely fill the prescription. But we're not going to be like an open haven for recreational cannabis.
All right. Thank you very much. So seeing no further questions, I would just like to invite Chairman Fairbanks and then Chairman Siki to maybe make a final comment. Chairman Fairbanks, do you care to say anything in closing?
Well, first of all, Madam Chair, I want to say miigwech to all the legislators that are on board today. And, both of our programs are going to be unique and, going down this path in partnerships with Minnesota. And that's the thing that we were talking about is partnering with the with the laws, with the testing, especially the testing part of it, is like we plan to have a good product for our people. We plan to be all the safety, you know, like what our attorney said, Lenny said, is, you know, we're looking at, you know, the medical cards where, you know, we have our regulatory, we have our cannabis boards, we have our, you know, we have everything in place. I think we're mimicking the state, what the state is doing right now. So I think that, you know, that we are going to be hopefully as good or better than what the state plan is. And like what Red Lakes is, to be more affordable, to have a product out there to deal with the issues that we're having, of course, throughout our reservation, you know, and that could be anxiety, that could be depression, that could be many other things out there. And I don't want to open up this can of worms right now, but I'm just saying that there's so many other underlying things. And looking at the state cannabis, the program they have now is, it's expensive. It's like, you know, the underlying conditions could be probably be more in there, especially with the veterans and the VA. You know, I know that there's lots of other things out there that we could look at and how that us as in the nations, Red Lake and White Earth can improve and help the, not only our band members, but in the future, help the citizens of Minnesota. So that's how I want to say, Miigwech, and thank you for your time. Miigwech.
All right. Thank you, Chairman. Chairman Siki,
if you like Madam Chair, thanks for Miigwech for allowing me to make closing comments. And it is a good opportunity for our members that are in need of this medical cannabis. There's many issues that our tribal members are going through, and others, even in the state of Minnesota, there's others that's non-Indians that are going through the same thing. And these are the things that we want to provide for people that need hope. And I want to ask the legislators here that what we presented is a good way for partnership with the tribes of Northern Minnesota, White Earth and Red Lake. This is a good opportunity for us and good opportunity for the state plus White Earth that we will do what we need to do to follow the guidelines that are set forth for this cannabis program once it's approved and allowed to do, we'll do our best and be transparent to the state of Minnesota. And I want to say, as the legislators, as you do your chicken cack pond, please think about us to approve this legislation or requesting. Miigwech.
Thank you, Chairman Siki. Representative Freiberg, before we vote, anything that you would like to add as the author?
Well, Chairman Siki and Chairman Fairbanks, I think, put it better than I could, so I will just renew my motion that House File 3162, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
All right. Very good. So Representative Freiberg renews his motion that House File 3162, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. Ms. Niedernhofer will take the roll on the bill. Chair votes aye.
Chair Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Yes.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, yes.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer votes no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Bonner votes aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damath.
Damath, no.
Damath, no. Representative Freiberg.
Freiberg votes yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, no.
Grunhagen, no. Representative Keel.
Keel, no.
Keel, no. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye. There are 14 ayes and 5 nays.
There being 14 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to the Judiciary Committee. Thank you very much to all of our testifiers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
everyone. All right. We will now move on to our next bill on the calendar, House File 3242, Representative Olson. And since Representative Olson is not on the committee, and I assume she's here, although I don't see her at this moment.
Madam Chair, I am here.
There she is. Okay, great. So the chair will move that House File 3242 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And Representative Olson, I understand there is an author's amendment. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. And is that the is that an A1?
That's the A1 amendment. That A1. Is correct.
Okay. And Representative Olson, did you want to describe that or shall we just adopt it and then describe the bill with the amendment?
Madam Chair, it'd be great if we could adopt it and it would be included in my overview as well as the testifiers would be speaking to it.
Very good. So the A1 amendment is the author's amendment is before us. So all in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So Representative Olson, you may present the bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So it's no surprise that we're here to talk about nurses and what they're asking for support in some pretty difficult times over the last 2 years. And we know that nurses have chosen their line of work out of a remarkable spirit of caring for their fellow Minnesotans. And since COVID first arrived, we asked the world of nurses and other dedicated people in our caring professions. With increased numbers of patients entering our hospitals, including emergency rooms and ICUs, nurses have been pushed to their max. They're overworked and they're exhausted and they're emotionally drained. But to be very clear, this nurse staffing crisis and the inability to keep nurses at the bedside has existed long before the pandemic. According to a 2021 report from the Minnesota Board of Nursing, new RN graduates have grown from 4,713 in 2017 to 4,900 in 2021, despite the pandemic. And the total number of licensed nurses in Minnesota has grown from 107,323 to 118,141 over the same period. There are more registered nurses in the state than in the last 5 years. Minnesota continues to train more than enough nurses to meet the needs, yet we struggle to fill the open positions due to the hazard and challenging work environment. This will only get worse without action, as the Board of Nurses has also estimated that nearly 1 in 5 nurses will leave the profession in the next 5 years. The pandemic has provided us a valuable lesson about how the status quo isn't working for nurses or the patients they serve, and has highlighted an added urgency to addressing this already occurring problem. This legislation before you today is a significant step forward to address the shortcomings we've experienced in recruiting, training, and retaining nurses so our healthcare workforce is safe, sustainable, and patients are cared for. Today, nurses are bringing real solutions to this crisis with a comprehensive approach to retaining and recruiting nurses with House File 3242. This bill would require all hospitals in the state of Minnesota to create a localized staffing committee of nurses, staff, and management. This committee will put together a core staffing plan for each unit of the facility every year and will meet quarterly to determine if the staffing plan is still adequate and needs to be adjusted to meet the needs of patients. Each staffing committee will be composed of at least 60% nurses. While providing flexibility across hospitals and units, under the bill, each staffing committee plan must set a maximum limit on the number of patients that any one nurse could safely care for. Each staffing plan will also establish criteria for when a lower patient assignment would be appropriate. The bill sets up a dispute resolution process, penalties for noncompliance, and penalties for retaliation. This bill would also dedicate new resources to ensure we continue to attract and retain a skilled and diverse workforce of registered nurses in Minnesota. This includes broadening an existing student loan forgiveness program for new nursing instructors and appropriating new funds to launch a new student loan forgiveness program for nurses working at the bedside in Minnesota hospitals. This bill would provide yearly grants to hospitals to establish mental health programs for nurses and other healthcare professionals. The bill also provides an annual appropriation for the Minnesota Department of Health to develop and implement violence prevention strategies for nurses and patients in Minnesota hospitals. This bill would require the hospital staffing committees to review all concern for safe staffing forms filed by nurses and patients to consider changes based on the data. The bill would also establish an annual report for the Minnesota Department of Health on nursing data. This new effort would conduct studies on the state of nursing in Minnesota, including on nurse staffing and retention in Minnesota hospitals, the workplace environment, and the ability to provide quality patient care. So in short, this is a comprehensive solution to a problem we know exists. It's been brought forward by the nurses. And with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Olson. Appreciate that presentation. So we have quite a few people testifying today, and we've asked everyone to please try to keep your remarks to 2 minutes so that we have time to get through the bill. And with that, I would invite Mary Turner, welcome to the committee. And you know the drill. So, and everyone else that comes after, I won't keep repeating it, but please just state your name and go ahead with your testimony. Ms. Turner.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Good afternoon. My name is Mary C. Turner. I'm the elected president of the Minnesota Nurses Association, which represents 22,000 nurses across the state, 80% of all bedside hospital nurses in Minnesota. I am also a COVID ICU nurse at North Memorial Hospital in Robbinsdale, Minnesota. From my own experience and the nurses I talk to every day, I know that we are at a critical moment for our healthcare system in Minnesota. There's a crisis in our hospitals. Nurses are overworked and overwhelmed. Hospitals are understaffed and patients are overcharged because hospital management is putting patient care in the backseat to their bottom lines. But let me be clear, the COVID-19 pandemic did not create these problems. For over a decade, I and my fellow nurses have been raising the alarm about understaffing in our hospitals and the effect on patient care and safety. The pandemic has made clear to the public what nurses have been saying for so long, that we are in desperate need of action to put patient care and the hospital workers ahead of the profits of hospital executives. There are more than enough registered nurses in Minnesota to fill the need in our hospitals, and the number of registered nurses is growing every year. In a survey of our nurses, over 75% responded that they wanted to keep on working for the near future despite the pandemic. But short staffing and cost cutting by hospital management are driving us away from the bedside. Over two-thirds stated that they had considered leaving the bedside or knew someone who had, because of the effects of short staffing on patient care and working conditions. This is a retention crisis, which hospital management created and has the power to solve. As president of the Minnesota Nurses Association, I hear from nurses all over the state every day. And they have told me that this is a problem everywhere in Minnesota. Corporate healthcare systems have bought out local hospitals in greater Minnesota, replacing their community care model with profit-first approach to healthcare. The result has been closures, cutbacks, and understaffing, like we see everywhere at the hands of the healthcare executives. The Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act is our best chance to stabilize our healthcare system in Minnesota. And let me be clear, this is not a state mandate ratio bill. It is not a one-size-fits-all solution. It is a hyper-local proposal which would put nurses and hospital managers at the table together to set staff levels, which will help nurses stay on the job to provide safe, excellent care that our patients deserve. And it would provide funding for mental health services and loan forgiveness programs to help recruit and retain more nurses for the future. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon.
Thank you very much, President Turner. Next on my list is Tess Schlicksup. I'm saying that correctly. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Yep, it is Schlicksup. Hello, my name is Tess, and I'm a floor nurse on the Cardiac Critical Care Unit, where I've worked for 8 years. On this unit, we take care of patients with critical heart problems as well as COVID-19. About a year ago, I took care of a patient with COVID, and their story is forever imprinted in my mind and heart for how vital quality patient care can be for both patients and their families. This patient had been in the hospital for weeks and was unable to stay off their BiPAP breathing machine, which is a step below a ventilator. Due to their underlying lung disease, the patient probably would not have been able to come off a ventilator if they were intubated. The day I was caring for them, the patient told me that they wanted to take off the BiPAP and end their fight. The care team came up with a plan to ensure comfort and dignity with their imminent death. Due to the COVID status, no family was allowed in the room. The doors of the room were made of glass, so their children and spouse were able to sit outside and see the patient as they died. I set up my personal cell phone and used the speaker function so that they could talk to their family when they were able to. When they felt they were ready to take off their mask, I alone was there holding their hand and reiterating how much their family loved them. Soon afterwards, the patient died, and with their family sobbing outside the door, the loss was tremendous. The expectation that after I tended to their body and the room was clean, I had a new patient to take care of in that same room within the hour. To compartmentalize this grief without being given time to process is in no way new to nurses, but the number of times per week and month that is needed, that this skill is needed, has increased exponentially. That patient deserved all of my time and attention during their dying process. Yet during that shift, I had two other critical patients who needed care. And it's common for nurses to have larger patient assignments. The thought of needing to divide my time and attention in three more ways is at best absurd and at worst neglectful with the intensity of care that I provide. I ask that you vote yes to ensure patients statewide get the care they need, not just what time the nurses can spare. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nurse Tess, and thank you for the care that you provide, and of course, the same to President Turner. Callie Pettigrew?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Callie. I am a staff nurse at Children's Hospital in St. Paul, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about my experience working as a registered nurse at Children's Hospital. I've been employed there for 5 years in various clinical roles. And let me just start by saying that hospitals are responsible for providing safe working conditions for their employees, full stop. However, executives have shifted the needle on what is normal in our roles. Chronic short staffing is no longer a crisis. It's a strategy. It's a profitable strategy. It's an inflexible strategy that does not allow for changes in patient needs. I put my license on the line every time I clock in, and my hospital does not have an equal responsibility or consequence when they do not provide safe staffing. In my world, when units are short-staffed, it's children and families who suffer. Recently, on a very typical shift without nursing assistance, I needed to give seizure meds, de-escalate a patient who was having a panic attack, and clean up a patient who had a large bowel movement. These three patients needed me at the exact same time. Who do you see first? Whose need is the greatest? How long is acceptable to wait in your own waste? How long is acceptable to wait in mental distress? How long for critical seizure meds? We enter our profession to care for the needs of our children in our care. And when we cannot meet the needs of the children in our care, we feel inadequate. Children and families suffer, and nurses suffer moral injury. The weight of chronic understaffing has caused numerous colleagues to leave the bedside. I've lost an entire unit, a floor of nurses. experienced practitioners guide new nurses in their practice, and the fatigue of years of inadequate staffing weighs heaviest on those who are experienced. They are exhausted, overwhelmed, and their mental health is suffering. There are open conversations on my unit regarding mental health therapy, medication, and other nurses frequently complain of insomnia, and some admit to increased alcohol consumption. These nurses leave the bedside, and their years of experience go with them. The pandemic is a contributing factor to short staffing, but this is a chronic issue that needs direct and real intervention now to prevent catastrophic staffing crises in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And again, thank you for the care that you provide to Minnesota's patients. Priyanka Roy, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you all members. My name is Priyanka Roy. I am a bedside nurse at Fairview West Bank campus. I have been a nurse for only 1 year and 3 months, and I am already exhausted. I cannot remember a time when I come to work and we are not understaffed. This means that I am always taking up more patients with high acuity. We have a lot of COVID patients, and I am essentially doing the job of two nurses. A lot of time, I have to do double shifts because there is not enough oncoming nurses in the next shift. So that means I'm working 16 to 17 hours a day, and I am very lucky if I get one break during that time. I have to ration out my care because it's humanly impossible to do everything that I should do as a nurse when I have so many patients. So I have to decide which one comes first, the pain medicine or the insulin, the taking to the bathroom or the antibiotic. And I have to do all of these and ration out my cares. And I come home every day with my spirits crushed a little bit because I didn't become a nurse to do this bare minimum. I became a nurse so that I could give my patients the best care. And I love being a nurse. I love my patients, but I don't know just how much longer I can do it. This is why nurses are leaving the bedside. I have so many coworkers who have left and they have just quit the profession for good because trauma, because they could no longer handle it. And I am resisting. I am trying to fight against it. I am trying to show that we need to treat healthcare as a social good and not as a commodity. We shouldn't be making profits out of patients when they're at their most vulnerable stage. If you're looking at healthcare as something to make profit off of, then you don't look at the patient outcome as a good, efficient healthcare. You look at how many few nurses you can hire to care for the most number of patients so you can make the most amount of profit. This is what the hospital executives must come to the table to fix. Hospital staff with ratios already, we are just asking those ratios to be safe. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much. And same to you. Thank you so much for the care you provide to Minnesota's patients. Carrie Mortrude.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Carrie Mortrude, and I'm on staff with M&A. Prior to coming to work for M&A, I was a cardiac telemetry and cardiac ICU nurse here in the metro area. But after only 9 years, I had to leave because staffing was so bad. That moment I gave up is one I'll never forget. When I was told to put my open heart surgery patient in the hallway so I could receive a third patient, I knew something was seriously wrong. Staffing has only further deteriorated as nurses continue to struggle on the front lines of the pandemic to provide quality patient care. Research shows that safe staffing levels increase quality of patient care. The Federal Agency of Healthcare Research and Quality funded research which found higher patient assignments for nurses are commonly associated with higher rates of non-fatal adverse outcomes such as pneumonia, shock, cardiac arrest, and urinary tract infections. Additional research from over 60 different researchers demonstrates without a doubt that higher staffing levels lead to a positive impact on the quality of patient care. Despite claims from opponents, a study in the Journal of Healthcare Finance determined that increased staffing of RNs does not significantly decrease a hospital's profits, even though it boosts the hospital's operating costs. In fact, additional research points to the cost savings hospitals can enjoy from safe staffing due to lower levels of hospital readmissions. Even California, with the most prescriptive staffing standards in the country, did not see any hospitals go out of business as a direct result of this staffing law. This legislation is different than those staffing bills passed in California. Rather than legislate hard numbers, this bill creates local staffing committees at each hospital to ensure that direct care nurses are able to voice their concerns and utilize evidence-based standards, patient acuity, nursing intensity in determining the proper staffing levels for hospital and improve patient care. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I can take questions at any time. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, we will now go to Margaret Kalina.
Madam Chair and members of the committee,
Thank you.
I'm the chief nursing officer for Alamere Health in Alexandria. I'm also the RN representative on the governor's task force for rural health advisory. Alamere Health is county owned and operated hospital and health system and serves the populations throughout Douglas County and the West Central region of Minnesota. In the summertime, we serve all who come to our beautiful lake region. I've been the chief nursing officer here for the last 31 years. This year's bill would mandate that every hospital have a staffing committee and that the staffing committee would be mandated to have 60% of its membership be members of the union representing the RNs. The hospital would be required to follow the staffing plans passed by a simple majority of the staffing committee. I am concerned that this bill could lead to unsafe patient care. Currently, we flex our staffing plans to meet patient needs in collaboration with the charge nurse of every unit, every shift.
And Ms. Kalina, excuse me one second. We're getting a lot of echo on your feed. If we just started, I don't know if you have two mics open or something. Okay, we'll continue. We'll try to see if we can get through it.
Should I back up a little bit or stop? Okay. So what our current practice, how does that sound, Representative?
No, it's still very echoey. I assume other people are hearing that as well. Yeah, they say they are. Maybe if you do back up a bit. I don't know, it just started, so.
Okay. So the current practice we have for staffing is to collaborate with that charge nurse on every unit, every shift. And we really value that collaborative approach with the nursing supervisor and that charge nurse, and we would want to retain that practice as secure as possible. I was very surprised to see this bill this year. That the pandemic has left our hospitals and health systems fragile at this time. All of us in healthcare are tired and exhausted. The care team is comprised of numerous important healthcare team members. In addition to RNs, we have LPNs, nursing assistants, respiratory therapists, lab professionals, security guards, and housekeepers, to name a few. I see the importance of our entire care team working together. All hospitals are experiencing healthcare worker shortages, not only for nurses, but for all of the healthcare team members. We currently have 70 vacancies across all departments. Our most difficult positions to fill currently are nursing assistants and housekeepers. Please help us with that workforce shortage. Thank you. Sorry for the echo here.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Kalina. I think we could hear you, so I think we did okay. Sharon Schneller?
Madam Chair, I'm Sharon Schneller. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Schneller, and I'm the Chief Nursing Officer at Olmsted Medical Center, a safety net hospital particularly serving lower income and diverse families in our community. This bill adds great administrative burden in an already very stressed system. It requires that we publicly post each unit staffing plan, every shift, and how many patients each nurse cares for on that unit. patient care must be dynamic. Hospital leadership, in partnership with their charge nurses and other nursing staff, constantly assess clinical needs and adjust staffing to meet the needs of our patients. During a shift, patient acuity may change. We discharge patients. We add and admit new patients. Picture someone posting and reposting this plan multiple times during the day as we meet changing patient needs and volumes throughout the day. Another concern is the mandated MDH secure portal to receive anonymous complaints for unsafe staffing. This bill does not define unsafe staffing. Two things are really important here. One is patients' needs change constantly, and not all nurses are the same. A nurse with 10 years of experience can manage a patient load very differently than a new grad, and we need to take that into consideration every moment. Staffing is not unsafe just because a nurse is asked to care for one more patient, differing from the posted staffing plan. Each hospital needs to discuss staffing needs with their core team and ensure patient safety. Sorry. My greatest worry, if this bill is law, is that OMC, my hospital, is forced to close beds or units, limiting access to patients we serve. OMC does not have a collective bargaining agreement with M&A, but we still would have to have a mandated to have a staffing committee with 60% non-managerial registered nurses. Please don't tie the hands of the nursing leaders. We are prepared to look at changing patient needs on nursing units in our hospital, and we work as a team with our clinical staff, our registered nurses, to assure that we effectively care for our patients. Please help us keep that partnership intact. Thank you for considering my comments.
All right, thank you, Ms. Schneller. Andy Cochran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee. I'm Andy Cochran. I'm the Chief Hospital Officer for North Memorial Health. And while North Memorial Health primarily serves the Northwest Metro, we care for patients from every corner of Minnesota because we have statewide reach in our medical transportation division, both ground and air ambulance. This pandemic has been challenging for us in a number of ways: significant shortages of supplies, of staff, price gouging on supplies and agency staff, and numerous surges causing us to stop essential surgeries for multiple months at a time. Throughout the pandemic, we've maintained team member and patient safety as a top priority, and we work as a team with open communication across the organization to gather input and feedback. This bill is not necessary for input and in fact removes the very flexibility we have learned to be critical in working as a team to best serve the constantly changing needs of our patients. We have these conversations today. At North Memorial, we have collective bargaining agreements with 10 different unions. This bill, if implemented, would concentrate on resources that are just one part of the team, likely forcing us to cut other staff and services. We owe it to our entire care team and our patients to balance our resources across our hospital and community, not just for one group within the team. This bill supports mandates that will likely force us to close units and services in deference to subjective staffing plans. Access to care that is truly needed would be impacted, and this should be unacceptable to all of us. We currently have over 700 positions open across our organization, and we want to work together with state agencies, higher ed, the legislature, and our multiple unions to bring about some stabilization in the healthcare workforce. This legislation would likely worsen the current workforce crisis we see across the state. Thank you for allowing me to share some of our concerns today.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cochran. Kelly Hagan.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Hagan, and I'm the Vice President Nursing Officer at Sanford Bemidji Medical Center and Clinics. We're a regional referral not-for-profit healthcare facility serving rural northwestern Minnesota. I've been a nurse leader for about 25 years and a frontline nurse for 15 years. I want to relate that this bill could impose a three strikes or out policy for hospitals. I was shocked when reviewing the bill language to see that the OHFC finds that a hospital has not corrected perceived deficiencies in staffing, and that after a third reinspection, there could be a recommendation to suspend a hospital license. This is an inappropriate penalty, one which could endanger the health of Minnesotans if staffing plans fall short, or more specifically, registered nurse staffing plans fall short. Hospitals would be required to submit within 60 days of the end of each quarter incidents of not meeting the staffing plan and the inability to adjust daily nursing schedules for increased patient acuity. Staffing needs to be based on patient acuity, the needs of our patients. Myself and my team do this every day, several times a day. We need flexibility to meet the required needs of all of our patients. We do have a collective bargaining agreement with MNA, and our nurses do participate in staffing and scheduling. If a nurse leaves work sick one day, I certainly, and our team tries to bring other nurses on, that's not always possible. They're not always there. In the Bemidji area, we already employ most of the nurses in our area, not only registered nurses, but licensed practical nurses as well. This bill ties the hands of hospitals and health systems who own the overall responsibility of care delivery in their communities beyond the four walls of the hospital, one that we take very seriously. We operate a nursing home with 78 long-term care beds. If this bill were to pass as introduced, we would have to look at pulling those nurses out of long-term care, close beds in order to meet a ratio in a hospital unit. That would not be the best thing for our community or our patients. And every day we have a lineup for those beds. I want to close by sharing all patients are different and all nurses are different. It is an unfortunate belief that each patient's care is equivalent or requires the same amount of time. This way of thinking makes each patient essentially a widget, when in reality, we know that some patients require less care and some require more care and on any given unit at any given time. Leaving the decision about staffing ratios to a committee will not serve patient quality or outcomes. Each patient, each shift, each day are different in the equation of assigning nurses to patients. We have kept our beds open and open for patients by working together. Again, I stress we are a regional healthcare referral facility working with our regional facilities who send us patients every day. What happens when everyone shuts down beds and we cannot serve our communities? Thank you for the opportunity to testify in front of this committee.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Hagen. And finally, we have Mary Krenke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I want to be clear here, despite what has already been said, this bill is a ratio bill. While it might not plop a number down into the language, it creates a staffing committee that is required to have a 60% majority of organized MNA members. And it says in the bill that the hospital must follow the staffing plan created by that staffing committee. So be clear here, the staffing committee, it says in there, they are going to assign a specific number of patients to a nurse. That is a ratio. It may not use that language in the bill, but it is a staffing ratio. We are very worried that this bill, if you cannot meet the demands in the staffing plan, hospitals will likely have to close units. They will reduce the number of beds that are in service. They may drop service lines, but there's no question that they will have to reduce the number of patients that they admit. Now, in the cities where there might be multiple hospitals, but around the state, if you say that a hospital cannot admit new patients, there's no question that this bill will create an access problem to services. I want to be clear about that. This bill is an anti-access to care bill. I also want to mention that in 2018, in Massachusetts, the National Nurses United, which is the nurses union that the MNA is affiliated with, brought forward a staffing ratio referendum on the ballot. That referendum was defeated by 70% of Massachusetts voters. They voted against the bill primarily because of outcry from the mental health community. The mental health community was really worried that beds would be reduced and that nurses would be pulled from other care settings, nursing homes, Kelly mentioned clinics and other settings, and that nurses would be pulled out of other care settings in order to work in the hospital community. Ms. Mortrude mentioned the California staffing ratios, and I think it's important to note that in 20 years around the country that this bill has been tried in multiple states, California remains the only state that has passed staffing ratios. Costs have gone up in California, and there's been no demonstration of improvement in quality. So in closing, I would just like to say that during this past pandemic of COVID, our hospitals have had to be flexible to care for patients. They've had to be nimble. They've had to innovate. So I would really like to ask the committee, let's work on positive things together that can improve workforce. We've heard the numbers around the state about the number of vacancies, and we need to work on getting more nurses into healthcare and into our hospitals and into other healthcare settings. So let's work on what we can do in a positive way. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right, thank you, Ms. Krinke. So we're gonna go now to member discussion. I see Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I mean, Madam Chair, maybe someday. First of all, it takes a provider to see this, and I've worked on the bedside myself, but Mary Tess Kelly, and I'm going to slaughter your name, I'm so sorry, but you guys, if I would bet that any charge nurse I've ever worked for saw you report to her floor, they'd send you home because you need a break. You need a big break. And that's sad that we have to look at legislation like this to give you that break that you so much need. Administrators, I think, you know, you have rights to be concerned here, but for 10 years, even as a bargaining person myself, we've been talking about this, and it seems like it keeps coming back. Is it Sharon? You were right. You need to work with your core people, and who better is your core people than the nurses? They're at the bedside. They know the acuity. I maybe this bill isn't perfect today, but boy, we have a harbor pilot that's going to take it along its way with Representative Olson that is going to work with all of you to get it there. And I really think that we have to open up. I mean, Mrs. Krinke, I have a question for you real quick, if you wouldn't mind.
Go ahead, Representative Hewitt. She's on.
Sure. And you can defer it to someone else if you need to, Ms. Krinke. But don't hospitals already use staffing grids and ratios? And they don't, if they do, are they working well?
Ms. Krinke.
Madam Chair and members, and I would welcome comments from our nurse leaders here as well. Most hospitals have some type of staffing committee in place, and most hospitals get input regularly and around the clock from their nurses. The difference is it is advisory in nature. It is not mandatory in nature. So these staffing committees, they get input. Input happens all the time, but it is not a mandatory committee. And most of them are 50-50 and not a 60% majority. I would like to refer to Kelly if that answer doesn't meet what you're asking, Representative Hewitt.
Representative Hewitt?
I feel that answers it unless, Kelly, I'm sorry, I should call you by your last name. I apologize for that, unless she has something to add to that.
The only thing I would add is
Ms. Hagan.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hewitt, I just would like to add that the collegiality that we need to have in regard to caring for our patients is really front and center here. We need to connect. We need to do this together. We are already doing that. We do this every day, several times a day. I'm not sure tying our hands with that potential ratio from a staffing committee would help us in any way. We all want the best for our patients. We all want the very best for our nurses, and we work hard every day to ensure we're doing what we need to do to care for patients. Numbers of nurses is also of concern, as are the number of support staff we have. Let's work together to enhance those numbers, and then this problem would diminish significantly.
One last comment, Madam Chair.
Representative Hewitt.
Yes, and that's exactly what we want to do here. We want to work together to do what's best for our patients and to get everybody's opinion. I don't like that this is known as an M&A bill. This is known as a pro-patient bill. And as it goes along the pathway, I think you'll see improvements. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. So I'm going to let everybody know who's on the list here. And we do have to end the committee at 4:30. So just to let everybody know. So we've got Grinhagen, Ackland, Bolden, Ryer, Bonner. And go ahead, Representative Grinhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, very quickly, because I know there's some better qualified people than me to comment on this. But I, you know, about 16 years ago, I was in the hospital for about 10 days, and my nurses were angels, okay? In fact, I checked to see if they had wings once in a while. But they gave me just great care, and I sincerely appreciate that and empathize with them. I do agree with them that the corporate takeover, it appears, of the hospitals and the nursing staffs has had detrimental effect. I'm old enough to remember when you had community hospitals, you know, Glencoe Community Hospital, Hutchinson Community Hospital, and for some reason we didn't seem to have these problems, okay? And now that the corporate takeover has taken, we seem to be festering even more problems. On the other hand, you know, the bill could close a hospital. I have a lot of concern about that. Also, when I was chief negotiator on the school board for 6 years, one of the things we were told by MSBA is do not negotiate your legal supervisory rights away. And I'm afraid that's what I see this bill doing. It undermines the supervision and decisions of the hospital administration. I'm not saying they're perfect, but the point is we have to come to a better solution than what this bill does. With that, I was going to ask questions, but I'll pass to let other people say something. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gernhagen. Okay, Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And truly, thank you to all of the nurses who testified. Their stories are very moving, and I sympathize with them because I too have am a nurse. I'm still a registered nurse. I actually practiced nursing for 45 years. And in that time, I was sometimes a staff member and sometimes I was in the supervisory role. So I've been on both sides of this coin, and feel like I can understand it after 45 years of practicing both in the hospital, practicing in the clinic, practicing in the emergency room, practicing in hospice, had a lot of experience, and staffing was always one of the key issues. It has always been a key issue, and this is like not new to the last 2 years of the pandemic. It's always been an issue because patients change, circumstances change. They don't change shift by shift. Sometimes they change minute by minute, and so I understand the problem. I feel like that these issues aren't going to go away by creating this committee. I feel like this legislation, state mandates, state rules to run organizations or to help with this has a good intent, but I'm afraid that it will cause additional problems or just create other problems. So I want to just say that the way this bill is written, I don't support it. I understand your problem. And I will tell you that one thing we did when we had a serious staffing issue is we did self-scheduling. That was the happiest time of our time working when we were able to do that because it worked because we worked together as a team. When they took that away, when it created a lot of unhappiness. So I think there's better answers to this solution, to this problem. The problem isn't going to go away because it's been there for 45 years that I know of, and it will continue because of the nature of our practice. So thank you for your work as nurses, and I just hope that we can work together with our administrators to find a real true solution to the problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative, so I've got Bolden, Ryer, Bonner, and then I've Damuth raised her hand now. I don't know, Representative Damuth, if we're going to be able to get to you, but we'll try because I also need to let Representative Olson have a final word here. So, Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will try to be brief. I want to start with some words of gratitude for the nurses on the committee today. Thank you for being here today to share your voice and your story. Thank you for the work that you are doing and have done for the last 2 years in a pandemic and even before that. As a registered nurse myself, I can empathize and, you know, have been in your shoes. Not in a pandemic, which is very different, but just really appreciate all that you're doing. And just want to recognize that, you know, as I talk with many, many nurses in my district, being short-staffed is something that comes up in literally every conversation. It is a huge issue, perhaps the number one issue that I hear from nurses. And as we have said, it is not new. So I am looking forward to working on collaborative solutions. Clearly what we are doing now is not working. And it is not working for nurses, it is not working for patients, and we need to continue to work to change that. And so thank you also to Representative Olson for bringing this bill. It's really, really important. I also wanna just flag the other pieces of it, which are really, really also needed and important. The mental health supports for nurses is absolutely necessary. The level of trauma and moral injury you all have been experiencing is something that's really hard to put into words. And so support is necessary. The pieces for student loan forgiveness and helping to get more folks, into nursing in general and to be nursing instructors is also really, really important. So there's pieces in this bill that, you know, I hope we continue to have those conversations and look forward to working with you, Rep. Olson, to make that happen. So thank you again.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bolden. Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I'll be brief. The observation I have is that often in organizations where there are power differentials, I will often hear people on the administrative side, the administration, say things like, we need to work together as a team. We emphasize teamwork. We're all in this together. And what then I hear from the people who are more directly affected, in this case, the nurses, is anything but teamwork, anything but feeling like they're being treated as a valuable part of a team. And when that goes on and on and on for years, as this has done, this is the situation where finally it's like, well, we have to do something that resets the relationship, and that's what I'm seeing. I believe that Representative Olson will work through with this bill. I think it's a great start, and some of the things that can be improved will be improved. But I would just like to call attention to the pain and the lack of solid, healthy relationship amongst the sides and make sure that that gets the attention it deserves, because the humans here, the patients and the families, of course, but the caregivers are suffering, and we can't accept that as tolerable. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Bonner.
Thank you. I'll try to be very brief. I just wanted to say, you know, we've listened here too about things like the sky is falling. Let's be clear. The sky is not falling. We are not closing down wings or pet or anything of that nature. However, I think there's a real opportunity to hear today that has been missed. And that is this, that we have nurses who have been crying out for some time now, trying to tell you that there are things about their daily life that aren't working. I can tell you under the current system, having known someone who was a nurse and in fact in charge of an ICU unit, there is often a pressure to reduce staffing numbers and sometimes even veiled threats that come along with that from management. So what the nurses are trying to tell you is we are having a problem and I don't feel like we're listening. Now, will this bill do all of that and solve all of those problems? I don't know that answer, but I feel like there's a real opportunity to be having a conversation with our nurses that's being missed here. And I would encourage our hospital administrators and folks in charge to be having those conversations with the nurses and figure out how to solve this once and for all. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Damuth, we got to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Ms. Trinke. And the question is, how would this bill impact the quality of care that is offered by our hospitals?
Yeah, and Ms. Krinke, I think you kind of addressed that before. Could you do this like in 20 seconds? Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, Minnesota always ranks in the top five states for our quality measurements, and so we're very proud of that. And so I do think that that is important to note. And I just want to say also that quality is not just about one category of staffing. It's also about our care team. So I want to just shout out that it's about our respiratory therapists, our LPNs, our laboratory professionals, physicians. It is about our whole care team. And we've seen that during COVID. So quality is not just based on one category of employee. It's about your care team that you bring to take care of the patients. So thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Olson, you may have the final word.
All right, thank you, Chair Liebling and committee members for a great discussion on the bill and really appreciate that. I'll just really quick, because it is a big bill and I just wanted to clarify some of the testimony, that this has not been tried in California. What you are seeing here is nurses bringing forward a solution that is very different than what they brought forward before. As I think both of my colleagues, Representative Bonner and Representative Ryer, have mentioned, to really try to, in earnest, to work with the hospitals to figure out how can we do this in Minnesota in a way that works for our folks. And they're doing it in a way in this bill that includes all the staffing. The entirety of the staffing team would be considered when thinking about these plans. And I've heard it a couple of times today saying it would be 60% MNA nurses. And to Representative Hewitt's point, this is about all nurses in situations where there aren't hospitals that have an organized bargaining unit. It would be nurses voting for representation from their own ranks. So it's really meant to help all nurses and float all boats in the hospitals there. And this is really about collaboration and being a local model. This isn't a statewide mandate like what we've talked about in California. This is really a local solution to come to the table. And it is new. And so I would admit, and I have talked with stakeholders on all sides of this about really wanting to work on this, because this is new and introduced in a way where I think, again, we've all agreed here that there is a real problem. You know, both sides of the aisle today talked about, you know, patient care and our nurses. Someone, I think Representative Acklin, said it's been this way for 45 years. Well, I'm not satisfied with a shoulder shrug and accepting that we continue that way. I'm ready to move on and figure out what do we do so that the next 45 years doesn't look like this. And so this is a bill that really starts this, starts that conversation and has a lot of good things in there that I don't think quite got the time that we were hoping for given the short committee hearing or shorter committee hearing time. But I hope we can continue to work and talk about it, because I do think this is the time to have this conversation and probably long past the time to have this conversation to support our nurses. So with that, I will just close and say thank you to our nurses, and I look forward to keep working on this as we await a fiscal note and all of the other work that needs to be done. So thank you for letting me get a longer last word in there, Representative Liebling. I really appreciate right. it, and to the chair. So thank
all right.
you.
Well, thank you very much, Representative Olson, and thank you to all of our testifiers today. We've been listening to nurses now. We've had a few hearings. We've heard from nurses about what's going on during COVID, and I don't know how you can hear the testimony of the nurses today and not say there is a problem. There really is a problem. And no bill that comes in with a solution is going to be perfect right out of the gate. And I think no one says that this bill is perfect in its current form. But I have to tell you that from my point of view as the chair, this is not going away. We're going to lay the bill over today. I think you can expect to see it in our omnibus bill. And I hope that there will be some significant work done before that point, because frankly, some of the testimony I've heard today from the hospitals, you know, no offense, guys, but you sound a little tone deaf when the nurses are here saying the kind of things that they're saying. And I can see that our members are hearing it that way. A lot of us are. So there needs to be some recognition of what these people are going through, or we're going to have an even worse problem when more nurses leave the bedside. So we all need to get together. I hope the parties here can work together and really listen to each other and figure out some real solutions, because this is about our patients in Minnesota. And frankly, I think the Department of Health, if it doesn't have the ability to close down a dangerous hospital, it should have it. I don't know, I would guess it does now, honestly. If a hospital is dangerous to patients, then it should be shut down. So that one doesn't throw me at all. We need to make sure that when patients go to a hospital, they can expect to have a certain level of treatment. I think every Minnesotan would expect that. So I just want to thank everyone again. This bill is not going away, but as of today, it is being laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. So thank you, everyone. Thanks for sticking around a few extra moments, and we are adjourned.